But I thought it'd just be good to get a little bit into this particular hour to do, even though we don't all speak Spanish, at least to loosen up our tongues a little bit around some Spanish words musically. And I thought we'd just start with some very simple words that some of you may already know, even if you don't know Spanish. And the word is alabaré. Have you heard that word before? It means I will praise. And the song, it's a chorus, it's longer, but just the chorus goes, alabaré, 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 alabaré a mi señor. It's I will praise my God. And it just repeats, and that's all. Would you like to try saying that? Alabaré, 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 alabaré a mi señor. Wonderful. No problem.
How many times did you say it?
I'm not sure. probably about four or five. It'll fit the music.
Okay.
You'll hear it. I'm sure it'll. And the music goes like this. Alabaré, 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 a mi señor. And then it just repeats. Alabaré. If anybody knows the verses, just sing with me, and then we'll do the chorus once more.
Cuando el número de los redimidos y todos alababan al Señor, unos cantaban, otros oraban, y todos alababan al Señor. Alabaré, 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 alabaré a mi Señor.
I don't think the microphone picked you all up, but next time I'll do that. When I think about Central America and people I've talked to the last months or years or however long it's been, there seem to be three questions that always come out. And we'll see if they're questions we share or if you have other ones that you'd like to bring out. The first question is always, what's happening in South America? I mean, I read what's happening or I hear what's happening. What's really happening there? And then the question that falls very closely to that one is, why is it happening? That's a whole other set of concerns. And then sometimes, and not always, later on comes the question, what can or should we be doing about what is happening there? I'd just like to share with you briefly a little bit about who I am and how I come to be interested in this. And I'd like if we could also go around briefly and each of you could share perhaps some of your interests while you're here, and if you have any questions that are on your mind or heart or what you'd be looking for in this hour that we have together. I'm here basically, I think out of love, partly somewhere along, I don't know where in my Norwegian ancestry, there got inserted a real love for Latin American culture. And I discovered it through a number of interactions I had. I studied for a summer in Mexico once and in Spain also for a summer. I fell in love with the language and ended up majoring in German and Spanish as a teaching major, and was very fascinated by literature, comparative literature also. And then somewhere about a year after I graduated from university, I accepted a call to go to Santiago, Chile to work for Division of World Mission and Ecumenism in Christian education with the Lutheran Church in Chile. And I went down there in January of 1973. And was there for 5 years. And people used to ask me that first year if I'd gotten used to the country, if I had adapted, as they called it. And I, by the end of the year, I had to say yes many times I have adapted to this country. Because there were so many radical changes. You may recall that was the year of the military coup. And just a total, upside down turning around of everything that meant socially, politically, religiously. And it became a very important 5 years in my life. I think part of it had to do with a little bit of my own identity evolving in that. I went there very naive, a little bit open, but still very naive. And I learned a whole lot. I realized as I was there that I saw and I lived one reality. And when I came back to this country, I saw and heard another reality being expressed. And it became very painful in the midst of all that when I saw things that were happening in Chile and I became very angry at a lot of the presence of this country there and what it was doing to all of us. And so I had a lot of things to work out and how I felt as an American, being in South America during that time. I also learned a lot about theology. It was when I was in Chile that I saw a whole model of ministry and a very exciting thing happening in the church as the church took up its identity, not as the German church in diaspora, which it was when I got there. It became a church that cared about people who were suffering. And that was an exciting transition to live through. And it excited me and made me want to go to seminary. And I discovered when I got to seminary, however, that my theological formation had really already taken place. And seminary didn't destroy that. And we did engage in a lot of dialogue there. I had a lot to share, and there were a number of professors and students who were very open to dialoguing about that. So I began to realize how much I had received from the people when I was there and how much I had received from that situation. And I came back with a very heavy sense of responsibility to see that what happened in Chile didn't happen again anywhere else. And I cried a lot when I listened to the news those first couple years, and I'm a little more hardened now, but still very distressed when I hear the news and things that are going on and how we tend to respond to those. But being involved with people in Hispanic ministry and having connections there has sort of kept my hope alive as well as the struggle. And so I just wanted to share with you today a couple of things that I found helpful in my own trying to set apart or trying to interpret what's going on. Things I wished I had known 10 years ago that would have helped, but we could all write stories on that. So anyway, that's basically why I'm here. I'm now coordinating the Lutheran Coalition on Latin America, which attempts to bring together North Americans who share concerns and common loves and common sense of ministry in partnership with Latin America, our brothers and sisters there. So that's part of what I'm doing. I'm also in transition now. I was a parish pastor for 4 years in Los Angeles, working bilingually until a week ago, and now moving back east, and am evolving what I'm going to be doing in that process also.
Where do you live at now?
Pardon?
Where do you live now?
Here.
Here.
Yeah, Joe and I have a motorhome parked down at Fields Landing, and we're not here. That's where we'll be living.
Oh.
So we're really literally in transition.
Oh, okay.
Very mobile.
Okay.
Yeah. And just exploring possibilities for ministry. So that's what brings me here, and that's what brings me also to want to share with you today some things I have learned and things I would hope to learn with you and from you. Some of you I know have experience in Latin America and are resources in and of yourselves. And perhaps if we could just go around, if you could say who you are and where you're from and what your interest in Latin America is, and if you have any burning questions, that might be helpful for all of us to know who's here. We could start over here. Is that a good place to start?
Really?
Good? Okay.
I'm Ruth Muscoff and I'm from Brazil.
Oh, very good place to start. Brazil. Resource person, right?
Carlos too.
Oh, the two of you. Okay.
Yeah.
Wonderful. From where in Brazil?
From the south of Brazil, Rio Grande do Sul.
Okay.
It's very close to Argentina and Uruguay.
Yes.
And I'm here to know something about Central America in your perspective, because in Brazil we know something, and here the people know other things and very different from what I think is happening in Central America. So,
Very good.
Hi, I'm Bea Geis from St. Paul, Minnesota. I think it's hard to be a citizen and not be concerned. And I think we're all aware that what we read in the newspaper isn't always the exact truth. So I think it would be helpful to hear what you have to share.
Jody Kretzman, for the Summer Up Here program. Lots of interest in your knowledge and experience. It seems to me that borders don't make a whole lot of difference anymore, and that there's no particular boundary between domestic and foreign policy questions anymore, and for us, in this hemisphere anyway. And that therefore we need to sort of take these that issues like crisis in Central America more seriously as absolutely front burner kind of questions. I also have a great deal of interest in avoiding another Vietnam.
Avoiding Chile, avoiding Vietnam. Here in the front row.
Yeah. I'm Tom Baker, and I'm from Spokane, Washington. And I'm just interested in what you have to say, because I've been to Canada, you know, and that's the only other country I've been to.
It's your closest border, right?
Yeah. And I'm just interested in, you know, what your perspective on the situation is, and just interested in it.
Okay, good.
Yes. I'm Emily Morris, and I'm from Fargo, North Dakota. I think to save time, I would just have to echo what's been said.
Okay.
I'm Kelly Conker. I'm just up from Milwaukee. I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, from Albuquerque.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just curious to hear what happens here. And I had a class on Latin America, so I kind of have some space to stick in.
Okay. We'll go to the front row again.
My name is Dingenberg. I'm from Big Harbor. And my interest in Latin America, what I'm worried about is the communist takeover and a second Afghanistan arrangement in Central America.
Okay. Chile, Vietnam, and Afghanistan. The parallels, okay. Behind you?
I'm Don from Lafayette, Indiana. Mm-hmm. I'd just like to get a clearer picture in my mind.
Okay, back to Dan.
Now, Dan Erlinger, and I got some interest in Latin America came together from a year ago, and Carmen and I were on a trip with the two of you.
Mm-hmm.
And we were together in Nicaragua. We're also in Honduras, Mexico, and El Salvador.
Okay.
I want to hear more.
Okay. Mary?
Very late. Interest comes from working in social services in the United States, where I came upon the Hispanic community from Central America, learning their stories of why they had come to the United States. They were forced to come. And also some study experiences in Mexico.
It's
been a political issue as well as a spiritual issue. Okay, Karen? Karen Berlin, Dan, on that trip, continuing.
Traveling companion. Okay, Steve?
Steve Huey from El Paso right now. We lived in Venezuela for 11 years, and since we've been in El Paso, I've been working in Hispanic ministry. And each summer, in fact, when I go back now, I'll be teaching Hispanic ministry course for college students. And my wife and I publish a newsletter called El Puente to help create better understanding of the border, especially in Hispanic issues. So we have a real deep interest in this whole thing.
El Puente meaning?
The bridge.
Right.
Grace Huey, and I was listening as well. I just have a real love in my heart for the Hispanic people, and anything I can learn more about, that's where I go.
I'm Denise Stafford, good question. I go echoing everybody else, and also I have a very small.
In what city was that?
In the state of St. Paul.
In St. Paul, okay. Go to the back.
I'm Bob Baker. I live at Holden. I'm the Resource Center Director. And I'm interested in how we identify the crisis in Central America, and how much of that crisis is centered in South America, how much of it is based in Washington, D.C., how much of it is based on Wall Street. How much of it is based in the purse of me?
Okay, and back there also.
I'm Connie Baker, and I'm a librarian. And
politically, I want to know what's true and what isn't. And I'm interested in liberation theology and to have some questions.
Okay. Hello. I'm Carlos from Brazil. And we are going to live here in this country for 1 more year. Mm-hmm. And so very important for us to get some contact.
Are you going to be working in this country then? Studying? Or?
She's going to do an internship in Northfield, Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to work at the Lolof College.
Oh, okay.
By the
you may have a needed witness. Big questions. Okay. Good.
Joe Bart from where you're from.
Okay.
And I'm just very much interested in having traveled a lot myself in Latin America and anticipating a lot more involvement in Latin American issues. I'm interested in especially our country's negative and potentially positive effects.
And not escaping my attention, there are four people up above. Would you like to introduce yourself?
I'm Karen Martin. I'm from Denmark. The first 6 months I was in the country, I was living in a community in Georgia called Jubilee Partners that has kind of got a refugee program for Central Americans in this country, taking them from Texas and helping them get asylum from Canada. So,
I'm Brenda Saffron, and we'll call it Portland, Oregon. The more I learn about Central America, I guess the more I get confused. So, that is your lesson.
I'm Chris Tindall, from Pullman, Washington. And last spring, anyway, I went to Central America. I went to Mexico and Nicaragua and El Salvador. And that was the first time I'd really become involved with all of Central America and sparked my interest in and trying to learn more. And so there's an immersion experience for me.
I'm Doris Dirks from Camp Washington, and I just need to be more informed about Central and South America.
Good. Big group and a lot of different varieties of experience and I think obviously a common concern. I'm going to do something very briefly here, which talking about several centuries very briefly is a hard thing to do. But I would like to talk a little bit about two premises that are very important, I think, to looking at the situation now in Central America. And the first has to do with just the historical and sociological reality. And I think we sometimes tend to underestimate how much we are formed by our own history. We're fortunate to have people from a number of countries here, and if we had time, it would be interesting to delve into this. You might want to think about it. But how much of our self-image comes from our view of our own history? I think people from the United States tend to think of ourselves as freedom-loving, you can just throw out other words you know. What other things are we to ourselves? All the positive images we have.
Independent.
Independent, yes, independent. Self-sufficient.
Hard working.
Right. Very, that's why we succeed, right?
Saviors,
we jump in a lot. I had an image of myself when I lived in Germany that I picked up through the Germans' experience of North Americans as always rooting for the underdog, sometimes not taking the time to find out who the underdog was, but whoever looked like they were the underdog got a lot of sympathy from us, and I felt that to be true also from my own experience. But I think, yeah, people who are out to help others. Goodwill, I think, is something we associate with our country. It comes out of our experience. I think it's important to know that Latin American reality is very different than our own history has been in a lot of ways, and that their experience with us in that history has been very different than we perceive that history. And before we can realize how we can relate to each other, we need to acknowledge a lot of barriers and gulfs that are there. We had the privilege last couple weeks in May to have with us Bishop Ken Mahler, who is an AELC pastor, formerly Missouri pastor, who is now, for the last 10 years, has been the bishop of the Lutheran Diocese of Panama and Costa Rica. And he has worked in that area for 25 years. He's been living in Panama. And I heard him give a couple of talks that I found very helpful, and I'd like to share a little bit of what he said to us also in that light. And one of the things I guess that we need to realize, and I'll just share briefly some of these historical things and then open it up for us to discuss a little more too about possible responses from us. But one thing we may or may not be as aware of is that for the last five centuries in Central America especially, there's been a story of conquest and domination and oppression and impoverishment. And that's been a continuing story in which only the cast of characters has changed over the centuries. It has done a lot for how Central Americans perceive themselves and how they perceive the outer world, who for so many centuries has been exploding into their reality. And you mentioned a solidarity group of, was it anti-imperial? I can't say the titles are hard. Anti-imperialistic solidarity group too. The whole idea of imperialism, of one country dominating over another, is an everyday reality, has been in the history of Central America. And it first came about as a form of colonial expansion. That wonderful spirit that we see as a frontier spirit that, you know, propels us out to new adventures, on the perception of the people who are being adventured and experienced, it's a very different feeling. It's one of intrusion, it's one of intervention, it's one of a very negative, hostile aggression. And so we need to see that what we often perceive as a positive action on our part is something that's totally negative on the other end. The other sort of invention, other than expanding our own boundaries and just becoming bigger and bigger and better and supposedly and greater, is also a sort of a capitalistic economic expansion, the mercantile expansion. One of the things we discover when we get new forms of transportation is that we can sell more in more places than we could before. We also are capable of going out and getting more things to sell if we don't have it in our own place in order to have even more to sell and more to be gained by us. And those two particular factors have been very important in Central America because they have had continually breaking into their reality countries who come looking for things to sell. And they've gone through the mineral, the resources. They went for the most obvious, the gold and the silver and copper and all the other things. And then just looking for agriculture has been the main product recently. But there have been a number of very negative things that have also accompanied that expansion, both the colonial and the capitalistic form of expansion. And you may know what some of those are. One of them is one that we're very embarrassed about because it's part of our history too, and that's genocide, the genocide of whole groups of peoples. I know when I was in Chile, they have a very small indigenous population. They had, I think they had at least 50 or so different tribes in the southern cone of Chile. And nowadays they have about 14 people that represent all those indigenous groupings of people in some state or another, but so many were totally wiped out. And to tell the stories of people who are no longer, we think of Columbus coming around the end of the 15th century, And to realize when he hit Jamaica, the Arawak Indians there numbered about 60,000. But 200 years later, there were none. They were all gone. There's something about that particular fact that imprints itself on a people's history, to know that some of us were here once and then we weren't. And why did that happen? So a lot of the why questions come back to Central America. The other thing that went along with genocide, of course, is slavery. There's a very famous Central American hero, Bartolomé de las Casas. And he was he got to Central America, I guess, around the early 1500s. And it didn't take him too many years to be really appalled at how the Indian peoples were being treated. And he started organizing to do something about this and really identified with the peoples. And they still have a deep love and respect for what he did. One of the things he did, though, he was so anxious to get the Indian peoples out of the slavery that they were in, that he advocated importing blacks to be slaves. And he really lived to regret that decision. But it was part of his own process of trying to deal with a situation that was appalling to him and sort of stepping into another situation at the same time. But that was all part of that whole history of people coming in and using the peoples who were there to rape the countries of their wealth in many ways. And that was something that is very painful for the struggling countries to realize that are very poor right now, that rape of the resources, because if you look at South America also, I think Bolivia is one of the poorest countries I can think of in the whole Latin American region. And yet for a period of about 150 years, Europeans were taking silver out of Bolivia. And in those 150 years, they more than tripled the European silver resources just in what they took out of Bolivia. And now Bolivia is struggling as a country. And it's important to see that economic situation, because we look now at those countries as underdeveloped countries. And we forget that when the Europeans came to Mexico and came to Central America, they were very advanced civilizations who had wonderful works of art, who had developed forms of irrigation, who had done so many things. They were not what we would call uncivilized. They were different civilizations. And as we talk now about developed countries who've become wealthy over all these centuries, a lot on what has been happening, what they've taken from other countries, and then wanting to go back to these countries and say, let us help you develop the way we've developed, but with some slight variation in the plan. We often are offended, like, why don't they want our help? You know, and there's something about knowing that we're part of that cycle of impoverishment, that we're not the saviors, because we've had another role in that too, and that the same thing doesn't work in one place as it does in another. That is something that is also, I think, very important to realize economically, that we're connected historically in some very embarrassing for us ways and very painful ways for our relationships in Latin America. The other thing that happened, the plunder for profit. Can you think of how many countries were actually in Central America doing this? Can you name the countries that were involved in this? Obvious ones. Spain is the most obvious to us. The language dominated, finally.
Britain.
Okay, yeah, England was one.
France,
yeah, was there.
Portugal
was, yeah, and there was Spain. Uh-huh, the Dutch were there also. There's still some more. Germany was there. The Flemish, the Genoese at that time. Many, many countries came through there. And it had its effect not only economically on Central America, and this is a diagram that Ken Mahler gave us that I thought was really helpful to me in visualizing this. You may not know what this is. This is a body of people. This is a group of people. We have a way of looking at our own country, too, that often blinds us to seeing other cultures. How would you put lines here? If you were going to put lower economic classes, a middle class, and an upper class, where do you think the lines would go for our country?
For our country.
This country, yes. United States.
High.
America.
High.
Okay, where would you put a line for a lower class, if this is the bulk of your people?
The lower class.
A lower economic class. Poor people in this country. Where would you put the line?
Okay.
Okay, we're going to start here. We have the poorest here in the bottom and the wealthiest here in the top. How do you think it would be divided up? Where should I put the line for the real wealthy?
I'd say about a third of third of the way down.
They're about here?
Yeah.
Higher.
Higher? Higher. Higher.
There,
that's right. Is that right about there? Okay, those are the wealthy people in our country. Okay, is that sort of a consensus?
Those are the wealthy?
Yeah, the most wealthy, yes. the very upper class. Do you think that?
How many categories are you going to have? Three?
Three categories. Oh. We have a wealth, a middle, and a lower.
You'll skip the upper, middle.
Yeah, I'm not going to divide up into those very obtuse categories. I really don't mean that. No, we'll keep it simple. I have to do this simple.
I thought that was you're comparing the United States to the world.
No, not to the world. I'm just talking within our own society. So we'd have a small group of really wealthy people. How about a lower poor people? How many poor people do we have in our country?
Whose standard?
Well, see, the government standard right now is $6,000 income for, how much for a family of four? Who is working in social services here? 11,000 for a family of four now. Well, it's really relative a lot in how we look at it, too. It doesn't really fit categories. But what, in a relative kind of way, how do you think this would go in here? Low, about here? Lower?
Higher.
Right here?
Yeah. I'm not sure middle class is that big.
You think the middle class is this big?
No. I go higher.
Higher on the poor?
Yeah.
About up here?
Yeah. Further?
About up here?
Higher.
About here? We'll try right there. It'd be interesting to see how this has changed over the last few years. I've worked in a neighborhood that's relatively poor, has a lot of people going through also that are homeless, and my image of who is and who isn't has drastically increased.
Right.
Still a place of dominance, a middle class. And you think that there are more really poor people than really wealthy people?
Yeah.
Okay. How do you think it would look in Latin America, in Central America?
Well, there's very little middle class.
Okay, you have to sort of close out the middle class a little bit.
Higher up for the richer.
Leader.
Okay, you put richer like up here?
Higher.
I can't go much higher. We'll go right here. Okay, you would go really small up there, huh? Okay, how about middle class?
A little above the next one.
Above this one here? Right about there?
More of it.
And you put all this in the lower income? Pretty good. This is not a scientific survey here. But as we were talking about this the last few weeks, looking at why it's hard for us to understand what's happening in Central America, part of it is understanding this whole population situation. With all the invasions that have come throughout the last five centuries, this great mass of people has been impacted. The word pueblo is a word that we use to describe, it means the people. And when you talk about the people, as Ken was explaining to us, so you're talking about this big mass of people that are right down here. When you talk about the people in the United States, generally we talk sort of about everybody, and we kind of focus on the ones in the middle. But the pueblo, according to the Central American reality, is in its largest part a very impoverished group of people. And there is a very dominant, I think this would actually might be a little bit bigger up here, this wealthy class, and I think the middle class would be even smaller. But one of the things that happened throughout history is all the domination that took place in these invasions of people, dominations of countries over Central America, was that this part was very much filled by a certain group of people. This part remained very much the indigenous peoples, a variety of Indian groups who were, for the most part, uneducated, agrarian-type living situations. And up here you'd have people who were doing the trading, who had the money. And you notice that what happened to the people then is that when they came, they not only sort of took charge of everything that was going on, but also they did some intermarriage and created something of a different class. And so you have those people, for instance, the Spaniards, who are the ones that became mostly the elite. And then the people that they had intermarried among became also another group of people they called the Ladinos. And they were a group of people that didn't have quite as much power or quite as much resources available to them as did the indigenous population, but they were also used to keep down the indigenous people. And so there was something about this whole structure that was built up. The main institutions that do exist in Central America are, you can imagine what they are. Thinking of three big ones.
That's the major institution.
The church.
The church. It's a, yeah, very big. And the main power is the main institution.
Army.
Yeah, the military. And one more that's often connected to the military or part of the military.
Government?
Yeah, government. Very synonymous, yeah. Some of these are all synonymous. You may find these are all synonymous. All of these very much were, this is not a pyramid, but as a part of this picture, are very much a part of this elite. And the church has had a very mixed history also in Central America. So part, the priest Bartolomé de las Casas was an exception. He had a vision of people that gave them a dignity that the institution at that time did not do. They were still in the process of trying to make Christians out of pagans. And or kill them, one way or the other. And he had a vision that that was not the way it was to be. And the church, in order to survive in a lot of ways, has established alliances also with the military and the government, through the government giving the church privileges to develop into what it was. The church also responded by legitimizing governments, which are often synonymous with the military. And sometimes they're both afraid of the military. I mean, it's kind of an exchange of power, a sharing of power, and a kind of an uncomfortable alliance among them. Sometimes people would come out of these places and go into these areas. Sometimes, like in more recently, one of the stories that most irritates me, thinking in Guatemala, is how the military in Guatemala has taken the indigenous peoples, and they will put them in the military, and they will send one tribe of people to fight in the other part of the country where they don't speak the language of the same indigenous people. So they'll be able to kill each other without seeing them as brothers and sisters who speak the same language. But there's actually plans to do that, to work that out so that these people are being used to serve these purposes in many more ways than done even in the past. But this is part of what's been going on over centuries. And as Ken has pointed out to us, and those of you who've talked to people who've been there or have had some experience or read histories about it, the military and the government have been notoriously cruel. The wealthy elite has not just sort of been a wealthy group of people that just sort of made their own money and left everybody else alone, but there's been just centuries of real serious oppression. It's been force and violence that has kept this mass of people sort of within the place that was allotted to them. And you can imagine for people in power in this little space how uncomfortable it must feel to be sitting on top of all these people knowing that something could happen there. There could be a reaction to what you were doing. And that's part of what was happening in this whole environment and what's been leading up to what's happening this century. That's sort of a little bit of history in just sort of the sociological sense and also something economically. But one of the really serious things for us to consider now is how much history is still going on in that same vein nowadays. I was having a discussion earlier about the numbers of invasions that have occurred just within the last century in Central America. And I'd read just recently that there were at least 30 invasions by United States and Great Britain within this century. And I've heard other numbers that there were at least, you've heard that there were 40 by the United States alone into the Central America region for the purpose of maintaining a certain government, for the purpose of training the military, and under the guise of supporting the church. And all these things have been filtered into this particular group. And so what happens now is that we do have a lot of conflict going on. We have a lot of overt violence. We have people fighting against each other. And the question comes up, you know, what's going on? You know, who is doing all this? And some of the stories that we hear, I don't know what you pick up from the papers here, but one, maybe you'd like to share what you hear, maybe some of the statements that you question as to what's happening there. One I hear most often is that Russia and Cuba are coming in and they're messing these people up and causing them to attack. That's one story that gets given out to us pretty frequently.
Attack who?
The the governing institutions, the government, the present governments and the military.
Oh, okay.
That, for instance, the upheaval in El Salvador and the struggles going on in Guatemala are the product of somebody else coming in and stirring these people up so that they attack their institutions. That's one image I think that's given to us. Yeah, Dan.
And another image is there's an extreme right and an extreme left, and everyone else is the people are neutral.
Okay.
In between.
Okay, and they don't care, but there are a few that care on either side of that. Okay, so we're told that there's no support for what's going on in that particular area. I think that there have been a couple things that really have impacted the fact that this mass of people suddenly are not fitting into the lines that have been traditionally given to them for the last few centuries. And one of the really exciting things about that is that one of the impacts on the people in Central America has been the church. We've all heard of Vatican II and what that did in terms of opening up the church to the people. There have been also a couple of conferences of bishops in Latin America. One was done in Medellin, Colombia. It was the second general conference of the episcopate or whatever it was called. And then there was one done recently, I think 3 years ago, in Puebla, Mexico. And what came out of that was a very strong sense from the people who were meeting that the church cannot operate outside of the social reality in which it's living. The church cannot preach the gospel and ignore the reality of what is part of everybody's daily life. And as a result of that, the thing that came out of that was something that you may have heard a lot of. It's called an option for the poor. Realizing that 85% of the people in Latin America are poor, the church decided that they needed to make an option for the poor. And you can imagine how threatening that would be for people who are in that type of a situation of control and power. And the result of that has been that many communities have been built up throughout all different countries in different areas. Priests and religious workers, lay workers, have gone into communities where formerly there was nobody. And they've laid out the Bible and discussed it together. People's dignity has been affirmed by their own participation in that kind of a process. And people become aware of their situation. I think if you become aware of your dignity as a person, you can't help but notice if you're being treated with indignity. And the priests have also been involved in the process of people becoming more assertive about what they would like to see changed in their reality. And as a result, the priests have been called communists because they have helped organize the people to ask for things that we in this country would consider our rights. And that's been something that's been very threatening to the establishment, and it's caused a lot of reaction. And it's been said that there are really two possible consequences of the church taking this option for the poor. And one of them is persecution. The church will be persecuted. And in a number of the books that are available, you'll find that there is a whole list of martyrs in Central America and Latin America of people who have been arrested, tortured, and killed, not because they were communists, not because they were organizing necessarily overthrows of governments, but because they were working with people and treating them as children of God that they were, and they were beginning to act like the children of God that they were, and that was threatening to institutional oppression. So that's one thing, persecution. And Tom Witt had just shared when he came up, I hadn't heard this yet, that Medardo Gomez, a Lutheran pastor, elected bishop in El Salvador, was just arrested 2 days ago. He was arrested the first time, I think it was a couple of years ago, and tortured and released. And since then, there have been a number of people who've always visited him, especially international visitors, who stuck close to him to try to prevent this from happening again. And he was apparently arrested again with two other church workers. And some of you have visited him and have had experience of the kind of work that he's doing. And I don't think that the kind of work he's doing is something that any of us would dare criticize as anything other than the sharing of the gospel that it is. And yet that's something that's been very, it has invited that persecution to the church. And the other thing that will happen too is transformation of the church. The church changes. And the only way I think that that can be shared is by people telling their stories. And if you talk to somebody about what happened after they chose to to be this way, to work in this kind of situation. They share testimony. For instance, in El Salvador, Melardo Gomez talks about a few years ago, before his arrest, the church was very small in El Salvador, and since then it's more than tripled in size. So what happens when you jail the people and you persecute them and you kill them is the church grows. And there's something about that challenges us, I think, to take seriously what we're looking at in our own response. But that's basically, as far as historical goes, what I just wanted to share with you. And the other thing, too, there's one of, yeah.
Can you speak with me so generally about church? As far as I am informed, there's a polarization within the church, too. That the more at the top, the church people are working together with the government, and that there are the normal priests,
mm-hmm.
they are more in different population. For example, in Nicaragua, that's very much that the archbishop is more the part of the conservative people, while the people, the church people who are in the government, that's quite a different kind of perspective about the situation in Nicaragua.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's my own bias, I think, when I say the church. But I think that traditional, you know, others may want to add to this, but I think that traditional structure of the church being in alliance with the government is one that's not been totally broken down. It has not been wiped out. I think a lot of what's happened in terms of the transformation of the church, and I describe that as the body of Christ, the bigger, not the hierarchy, but the whole works, has been on the base Christian communities, people working with small groups of lay people. It's sort of that leaven, you know, coming up from the base that has caused that transformation. And what happens is when that starts to come up, it comes, you know, into conflict with what's coming down from the top. And yeah, I think it's very natural that there is that conflict there. And it's a very painful thing.
Susan,
mm-hmm.
I just wanted to share, I think, one of the most significant things that this turmoil in El Salvador particularly has brought about is a new appreciation for the laity and the ministry.
Mm-hmm.
And Medardo explains how one of the things that has happened is there are only two Lutheran pastors in El Salvador who are fully trained, but in spite of that, the church is actually grown more in the last 5 years than it did in the previous 25 or 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for this is because the need for ministry is so great that they have had to break out of these traditional missionary molds of, you know, you have to have seminary and all that to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And they have really freed the people from ministry and have really involved deacons and elders and so forth in ministry in very real ways.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been very special to see.
Yeah, yeah. They have a strong lay catechist program, which something has been going on in the Roman Catholic Church for a period
and a good,
now.
A good mixture of what we might call word and sacrament and social ministry. It's not
mm-hmm.
either or, but a very definite caring for the whole person, which I think is part of the key to their growth.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is that while we look at all this as a terrible tragedy, which it is, and a very bad thing, despite what the Lord is using this difficulty to renew the church, particularly,
mm-hmm.
tends to show us that through suffering, sometimes the blessings do come.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there are people that are very filled with hope, too. I think just in what you were saying, too, I would not so much say it's a blend between social ministry, word, and sacrament. I probably want to say that they've really been able to integrate that into a whole.
Obvious,
yeah, I think that... you know, it's there.
Yeah.
Sort of organic.
The whole person.
Yeah. And it's something that certainly has to challenge us, but also that hope that they perceive. But the challenge is there for us, too. And the questions, you know, some have been raised already. The question of response. A Salvadorian said at a workshop I was at a couple weeks ago, somebody asked him, what should we as North Americans do? And his response was, you should change yourselves before you bother with anybody else. And, you know, it was just very much throwing back at us. Again, this concept that we can go in and fix something up, especially given that history, given the relationships we have, it's a very arrogant approach on our part. And the fact is that there are people, just as you say, the ministry is being carried on in a way it's never been done before. When it was a missionary enterprise, it's being done by the National Church, and it's, you know, doing fine. And also in the peacemaking process, there is a local, regional peacemaking process where the people are determining their own their own guidelines for peace. And that certainly challenges us when we want to come up with our own plan that we think we know best. I think of that old program, NTD Father Knows Best. It's that image that we know what is best for somebody else without listening to them and to that. But I don't know what other, you know, in terms of realities, and I don't know how this compares in Brazil. You've gone through a lot of these struggles, I think, also, in terms of other countries coming in, and I don't know if you see parallels in that or not. It's a somewhat different structure, but... No? That's true. Yeah.
In 1964, we have an elected government. Well, it was elected in 1961. And the militaries overthrew the government, and the American old army, navy, were in the coast of Brazil, just to make sure that the military revolution was successful. If there would be some opposition, and the American navy was there just to help. And what happened after that was all
How do you answer people regarding the issue of, I'll play the devil's advocate on all of this, because this is always a very real question. The question of the communist involvement and infiltration, there really is interest on the part of Cuba and Russia to do some things there and take advantage of the social upheaval. Every country is going to take a look at its own self-interest. So how would you answer a diplomat who is feeling for the United States in that area trying to protect or call our interests as a country? That's not just going to go away because we.
The last.
How would you answer a diplomat, you know, from our country who's responsible for helping to protect the interests of the United States in that region? As I say, I'm playing the devil's advocate, so I don't have the answer to that. But.
You can't be the devil's advocate that far.
We say yeah. Well, that we have interests. So what is, you know?
I think some of the interests are economic. For example, we have always, I always tell when people ask me this question, one of the things I say is, I like bananas a lot, you know. I mean, that's just an example. I really do. If I can eat a banana every day, I like to do that. But in order for us to have bananas, we have to get them somewhere. And
I like
so a lot of the
too.
Best agricultural land in Central America is dedicated to growing bananas for America. And this means that people in Central America aren't always able to get balanced diets of vegetables and other foods that they really need because the best land is already controlled by American-controlled companies. So I would say that one of our interests would be to continue keeping those kinds of interest, you know, economic interest.
American companies
American
that are
control.
Operating in Central
right.
America.
And we don't like to hear that, you know. As I say, I wouldn't like to have the bananas cut off either, but that's a reality. Are we willing to give up those kinds of interests?
Part of that reality, too, is the fact that, you know, if the banana price goes down, if you were without your bananas, you know, you might miss them. But, you know, if they lost their whole export of their one crop, which is usually what each of these countries has, is a one-crop exportation economy, they're devastated for a year, I mean, or more. And there's something about that real dependence on us that's also part of that whole feeling towards us as a country that we can so control them. But yeah, some of you probably have answered this question before too. Various, what you say depends on who you're talking to, but yeah, I think that challenging the interest, you know, what right do we have to have this kind of interest is certainly a point of departure for discussion.
I think people here get very angry when you suggest that we're somehow responsible for some of these things, exploitation of people and so forth. We don't like to admit that at all.
Right. Right.
But the answer is that they have not choice to grow what they want.
Mm-hmm.
They have to grow bananas or they have to grow orange because that's what Americans buy and like. And so I think that for a diplomat, it would be very difficult. American people, I think that they can understand that each country has to have the freedom and the autonomy to decide what they want to grow and for who they want to buy, to sell, and for what price. That's what I could say for an American. I think that it will sensitize.
But
would it really be better for Central America to get to continue this kind of thinking for communist government or communist influences to come in and exploit just like perhaps we have been exploiting? You see what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, yeah.
Between one exploiter or another.
Right. Well, obviously, ideal is not to be excluded.
We did a whole list, you know, yeah. Britain, France, all the way down. We could have added the U.S. and then maybe.
Oh, we did. This century is the U.S. is the dominant intervener.
If we could look down the road in history and see what happens. And, you know, could we add Russia? Could we add Cuba? Would that be any better? See, I think there has to be another alternative.
Yeah, I think one of the problems is when we get into those discussions, what we end up doing is using Central America as pawns. And we see this reality I didn't write even the U.S. or Russia in here, but because I see it really as a Central American issue. You're talking about history of injustice. You're talking about people that are being pushed down and kept down very unnaturally by violence. And when you see what happens within the people, you hear the stories of what's happening in their own transformation, and see that happening, that needs to be seen as a genuine struggle of those people, and to say that they are acting because we want them to or because Russia wants them to do is to deprive them, I think, of the ultimate dignity of determining their own fate. So in that sense, you know, we're always going to be missing the point, I think, if we're only looking at superpowers. And the other problem we have, especially probably in the church, is the fact we're looking at social change as communism. We're very ignorant about communism. I was never taught communism in school. And except in, you know, a couple of sentences. And so all of a sudden, anything that advocates social change or power to the people or whatever phrases you want to use looks ominous to us, and we're unable to participate with it. And so if anything negative does happen in terms of alignment with other countries, I think we still would have nobody to blame but ourselves for not aligning ourselves with the people, but rather with a small elite who is oppressing the people. And so in that sense, I think we have to look at our own connections there.
Well, the curious thing about it is that our country began as a revolution. And yet
very
curious, yes. We have put blinders on to anybody else's desire for freedom. You know, if another smaller country in Central America wants to achieve the same freedom, we get all bent out of shape as a country. Even though our own country began that way as a rebellion against Britain.
Yeah. The thing is, we're allied now with the Britain of that time, and we have that image of ourselves, and that challenges us. It really is complicated. You know, it's almost strange to look at Central America altogether, because each country has its own history. For instance, like Nicaragua, and you'll hear more about Nicaragua Wednesday night. We'll do some sharing about our trip there. It's a different type of situation, because in that country, the people have taken the power now. It's no longer a small elite that has the power, but it's the people who have the power. And there's a small elite who's protesting and doing activity against the people. But it's a different inversion of this. And El Salvador and Guatemala both have different histories, and Honduras does too. So they're all a little bit different, but depending on where they are. Tomorrow night I have a short documentary. It's called Witness to War. That I don't know if anybody has seen it. It's sort of a story of a North American who is a Quaker now. He was a former career military person who later became a Quaker and spent a year in El Salvador just tending, he's a doctor, tending to the people medically. And he tells something of his story. And so tomorrow I'd like to talk a little bit more about things that we do in this country and how we respond to situations such as that as North Americans. But so, you know, that'll be tomorrow night at 6:30. I think we have the slot in the same room with the projector. Because there are a lot of questions that are asked, and I'm sure we all get stuck for answers, but part of it's keeping the perspective of what the struggle is and what it isn't that that happens. This is open-ended here. So, but
I wondered about how do we how do we begin to affect change? Because these very people that are in that struggle and are beginning to see that they should have dignity, yet they have been subjected to brutality to such a degree, and their children are being subjected to brutality to such a degree, that I'm wondering if in any of our lifetimes we will, and even if in two or three generations, there could possibly be a restoration of a dignity to that people, because it's been so destroyed and devastated. You know, and I guess it looks so hopeless, you know, even though you say you see the little glimmers of hope, you know, yet...
Yeah, I think, well, we don't have time to do this now, but I would say that's one of the wonders of the gospel. Dignity can be restored, and it can happen very fast, too, but that, which is why a lot of this has happened. But and it's very hopeful in the midst of struggle like that. But maybe we could talk about that some more tomorrow.